Local Government Operations Committee to order. We were going to take Senator Berglund, Senate File 356 first. I don't see Senator Berglund here. Saw Marty in the hallway.
Right here.
Metzen needs to get in and out. We'll take up Senate File 1278. Welcome to the committee, Senator Metzen.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. This is a bill we call the Best Value Contracting Bill. I believe we have an amendment, the A1, that's been worked on. We were told at the last meeting that you might recall that trying to get lost and get some wording in and better wording, and I think we've done that with the amendment. So if we could, I think we're going to be working off of that. If somebody would kindly move that, then we'll try to explain it. But.
Okay, Senator Larson moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion? Senator Metzen, why don't you describe your amendment first, and we'll.
All right. I think what I'll do is give some general remarks, and then I'll have the experts kind of take us through it, the section by section. But the stakeholders, including state agencies, labor, contractors, and the League of Cities, and the Association of Minnesota Counties and others have met over the last few months and put this language together. It allows these state agencies, cities, townships, and school districts and other public entities to use what we call the best value contracting construction methods. Best value is a system that takes both price and performance into consideration when awarding contracts. This legislation would not do away with the low bid system, but instead would provide best value as another option for these governmental agencies to use. The University of Minnesota has used this a few times, and I believe, I might be mistaken, Hawaii has done this too, and where it's they can go to the, what they call the best value contracting. We believe that this bill is good government. This value will provide the best long-term deal on construction projects that the Minnesota taxpayers are paying for, and it would not just solely be the price and the cheapest price up front. They would talk about, again, the best value. It benefits Minnesota taxpayers because it looks at the best overall performance on the project, not just what appears to be the cheapest price up front. And again, it gives the legislative bodies, being the local governments, what fits their needs best. So they've got two options. They could look at this best value, and still they do not desire to go the best value, because they could obviously still stay with the low bid. Thirdly, it benefits Minnesota workers because best value creates a system that rewards skill and training. So I think with that, I'll let briefly, I know you've got four or five bills on the agenda, but I got Danelle LeClaire here and Meg Luger Nicolia. Might be murdering that last name, but would you like to go through quickly?
Yeah, we'd like to get a section by section. Remind me, though, we heard this some already, and then ours was the first committee, though, right? And then we sent you to get this A1 amendment drafted. So maybe we can move this A1 amendment and get the bill in shape. So Senator Larson does move the A1 amendment, and Senator Metzen has described it in general terms. Any discussion on the amendment? All in favor of adopting the A1, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Okay, we have the bill in shape, and if you could step us through, state your name for the record, and step us through section by section, that would be very helpful. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks. I appreciate the opportunity to speak. My name is Meg Luger Nicolai. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Miller O'Brien. We represent the Minnesota State Building Trades, and we've assisted Senator Metzen with this legislation. And I just want to go through this section by section. I don't know if you need a comparative analysis with the bill as it was, but to begin. Section 1 is the definition of best value. This would be subdivision 4A. This definition would apply to construction projects only. It emphasizes that the departments who use best value contracting must use price, but they may also consider performance criteria. And the section lists a number of performance criteria that can be used to gauge a contractor's prospective performance. It's also important to note that when considering performance, agencies aren't allowed to or will not be considering whether or not a contractor has sued the government before or otherwise exercised a legal right. Section 2 adds a definition for vendor. This is in the regs currently, but this is a technical amendment so that the statute can conform to other uses of the word vendor. Section 3 amends Chapter 16C.03, Subdivision 3, the acquisition authority for the Department of Administration, by making it clear that low bid is an alternative, as is best value. Section 4 amends that section of the statute as well by creating a special subdivision for construction contracts. Again, it's important to note that this applies only to construction contracts, and this section makes that clear as well. Section 5 adds a training provision. This permits the Commissioner of Administration to establish a training program for state and local officials who plan to use best value or may use best value. Section 6 amends Chapter 16C, Section 16C.26, by making a technical amendment to allow the consideration of proposals in addition to bids. Currently, bids are only used in the context of sealed bids, and the proposals would apply to the RFP process or request for proposals. It also creates a notice requirement for the departments using best value, which makes clear that the proposal language has to give clear notice as to what will be considered as performance criteria. And there are other technical amendments as well that conform to the other language in the statute. Section 7 is another technical amendment allowing the consideration of proposals in addition to bids. Section 8 is really the meat of the changes to Chapter 16C of the Minnesota laws. That permits best value in addition to lowest responsible bidder, which is currently the only thing allowed for construction contracting. And that refers to the definition that is proposed above Subdivision 4A. This also proposes an implementation schedule for the use of best value that permits a phase-in process. Essentially, state agencies, counties, cities, and school districts will be allowed to use it as an initial matter. Other entities will be able to use it within a year and then 2 years after that, so that there is time to kind of adapt to the system and perhaps learn, take advantage of some of the training opportunities that the Department of Administration may establish. There are some other technical amendments to allow the use of proposals, the request for proposals process. And additionally, Subdivision 4 of that section will be amended to make it clear that the Minnesota Data Practices Act applies to the proposals that are submitted. Section 9 is an amendment that allows the ditches and wastewater authorities to use best value. So is Section 10. Much of the sections that follow are amending local laws to permit the use of best value. So that is true of Section 11 as well. Section 12 amends the school district contracting provisions to permit best value contracting on their construction projects. And that is in Section 13 as well. Section 14 applies to small projects in the Department of Transportation. Again, it allows counties or towns to use requests for proposals and best value contracting in order to build roads. Section 15 is the same, although this applies to RV lanes and other small projects. Section 16 is an amendment to the Trunk Highway Statute, which permits the best value in addition to their existing methods, which are lowest responsible bidder and design build. Section 17 is a technical amendment that makes clear that the best value definition that we're using for regular best value design bid build projects will not be used necessarily for design build projects for which they already have a best value process. Section 18 is another technical amendment that makes clear the distinction between design build and design bid build contracts. Section 19 is another technical amendment permitting the best value usage. Section 20 is an amendment to another local law that permits counties to use it, as is Section 21, as is Section 22. And Section 23, that applies to St. Louis County ditch repair. Section 24 permits the use of best value on, I believe, this is for the Met Council. Section 25 applies to the port authorities, allows the Housing and Redevelopment Authorities to use best value contracting. Section 27 allows the port authorities. Section 28 is also another amendment for the port authorities. Section 29, similar language. Section 30 is another important amendment. This amends the Uniform Municipal Contracting Law, Chapter 471. This permits the use of best value for, in Section 30, contracts above $50,000. In Section 31, those are contracts from between $10,000 and $50,000. And Section 32 applies to contracts for less than $10,000. Section 33 applies to contracts that are greater than $50,000, but that applies to the Met Council. And Section 34 permits best value contracting in the construction of the ballpark. So it permits the ballpark authority to use it. And that is the sum and substance of this bill, this amendment.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, I see on page 5, 21 through 24, we put a limit on how often it can be used. Does that limit apply to all of the entities you just mentioned, townships, counties, school districts, watershed districts? Is it applicable across all of these sections that you just talked about?
Correct. That everything, sections, the at lines 517 through 520, the named entities in that provision are those entities that will be permitted to use it immediately. For lines 521 through 527, those entities, it will be phased in over time.
Chairman, I just want to emphasize for the second or third time, there are no mandates in this bill. It's another tool in the toolbox for the counties, the state agencies, and the people that have signed off on this. They just want a chance to look at this as another option. Quite frankly, I don't think a lot of projects will be done this way, but I don't know that. But it still leaves it up to the local agencies, the local cities, the local townships, the local schools. If they want to look at it and use it once in a while, they can. If they don't, they stick to the old method of just entirely the low bid. So it's one more option. And I guess personally, I've been convinced that it doesn't hurt anything to look at what might be the best value. It's not always at low price, as you know. It could be a combination of many of these articles. And is it going to be used all the time? No. We've done some of that design build on that. I don't know if you can compare it, but like the Stassen building and a couple of them over here where they were on the fast track, and we did some highway projects like this at Dick, similar to this kind of a thing where you get another way to do it. And Senator Day and some others are familiar with some of the highway projects that we let on the fast track too. So I think it's another thing that locals and locals still have control. I mean, you know, we're not saying you have to do this stuff. So I don't know. We got one more. I've got some people from the cities or other people, but
any other
and the University of Minnesota has done this.
Okay.
And they're here. And if you wanted a 1.5-2 minute deal, not a quick, you know, just to say if it worked for them, maybe that would be helpful.
I think that would be helpful if they're.
Who do we do here? Yeah, he's just gonna. You better sit where you are. How it's worked somewhere else.
Yeah, good afternoon. Justin Gressing with the University of Minnesota. Thank you for letting me take a moment of your time. I do want to reiterate that the University of Minnesota maintains a neutral position on the legislation as it does initially directly affect us, but we were asked to come here and give you an idea of some of our experience with it. One of the concerns that we hear quite often is that best value will translate to higher prices, and I'll let you know that in our pilot program of 27 projects, I believe 19 of which are completed at the moment, we have actually come in 13% under budget using this best value process. So it has not necessarily translated to higher costs, but it has allowed us to have a much richer project delivery process. We've gotten better value, I think, for our dollar. And if I didn't mention, I'm a director in the capital planning and project management area. Sorry, I'm not used to being in this particular venue.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering, because the qualifications require that you review past project work done, have you found that you are still permitted to use new contractors that haven't worked for you before? Or have you, if you're looking at past project work done and it's based on that, how do you incorporate new bidders?
Actually, what we did for our pilot program was, and the way that our system works, we ask contractors to provide us their best references on projects that they have done outside of the university, which allowed us to capture people who didn't necessarily work at the university prior to us using this system. So, and all we ask for is one survey at a minimum. So that's one way that we get people in, and we've tried to keep it as broad as possible because we do know that it can be hard for contractors to enter into the system. So we did try and, in our pilot program, keep that as open as possible. But we did ask them to provide references.
And just for clarification, that this, I guess we're talking about item number 4, vendor or contractor's record of performing previous projects on budget. That's also a permissive category to review, so it's not mandated either, correct? Yep. I mean, everything here is permissive, and it's up to the local control to help make the decision. Okay, that's helpful. Does the Department of Administration have a position on this? Is there anyone from the department who would like to?
So if you're not for it, you go sit back there.
Do you want me to stay up?
No, you're fine.
Okay, great.
Kent Allen, the Materials Management Division Director from Administration. This isn't an administration initiative, but we've worked with the authors and the stakeholders, and the form that the bill is in now is one that's quite acceptable for us. I agree with Senator Metzen. It's another tool for us to use. We'll use it more or less depending upon the experience we have and the number of resources we can apply to this, but we don't see any harm in having it available as another option.
Thank you. Any other?
We have other.
Other testifiers?
You're not convinced, we'll keep going here.
Okay. would you like more testimony? Or?
He's got about 32 seconds.
Okay. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Craig Johnson. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. Just want to be clear that the League of Minnesota Cities sees this as a very valuable tool for our members in doing contracting work in very specific situations. I would add that city authority for this in a similar type of use has already been established in the Westbrook Construction versus the City of Minnetonka case, where it was found that cities do have the authority to set criteria up front that they can, as long as all the bidders are aware of that criteria, so that they can use something other than or additional information to the lowest responsible bidder process. We feel this clarifies in statute what that case actually said cities can already do some of, makes it much more concrete for a wider range of uses. And we do have some experience with this and have found it to be useful in a few cases. It's not being used widely right now. There is one comment I would make to the A1 amendment. I believe the intent on page 5, line 10, was to make sure that cities were all included in phase 1, meaning that from the time the bill was passed, cities would all be able to use this tool, which is consistent with what we, or close to what current practice would be because of the Westra case. Because of the way it's worded there, we think there could be some confusion and would recommend maybe separating cities with a semicolon and having the schools be a separate line 4. If that was something that the committee wanted to work on, or we can work later with the author on that point if need be.
Senator Marty is willing to move that. Senator Council, Tom Bonner.
Mr. Chairman, we can do the amendment fairly easily. On page 5, line 9, delete end. And on page 5, line 10, after cities, insert a semicolon. And after and, insert paren 4.
Everyone understand the motion? All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you,
Mr. Chairman, if I may, in addition to the League of Cities supporting this, we have the Association of Counties and the League of Minnesota Townships. So I just thought the panel should know that we have broad support.
Excellent.
To try this product.
Any other questions of members?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Vickerman.
That's just a question. I'm a vendor, and I
I want to put my bid out to the lowest bid. Hopefully somebody's going to, that's going to be it. But you don't, if I read this, you may not even pay attention to my low bid. So why do I want to put out a low bid? Explain that to me. Why would I do that?
Could you repeat that, please? I missed.
Why the low bidder?
I didn't quite hear you.
Oh, could you please repeat your question? I missed that.
I'm not a vendor, I'm a farmer, but if I was a vendor and I was going to bid on this, I would do my very best to get the bid low, so I would, hopefully I would get the bid. Well, why would I do that when it says here you may not even look at my low bid?
Well, Senator, actually, the price is a mandatory consideration. They must consider price. And additionally, the fact that a vendor offers the lowest price doesn't necessarily preclude the fact that vendor may offer the best value. And I believe that the representatives from the University of Minnesota can speak to this as well. Having used best value, a number of the selected bids were also the lowest bid, in addition to bringing great value to the university and the taxpayers of Minnesota.
Senator, just one follow-up question. And my former life, the same as Senator Day, we were county commissioners. And we were always instructed, you better have a doggone good reason if you don't take that low bid, because you're going to get sued. So is this totally different than that? Or?
Well, you know, you were probably mandated to use low bid, and so you would have had to have a pretty good reason to do it. And this permits other considerations, but of course, The process is subject to the Minnesota Data Practices Act. I mean, certainly we would expect under this legislation that municipalities and agencies would be able to justify the decisions that they're making. But this allows greater information to be considered in determining what is the best value to the state than they currently have available to them. So it's hard to imagine why this would be reproachable in that regard.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, but when you do put out criteria for bids, you ask for very specific things that in a low bid have to be met to make sure that the project can be accomplished the way you would expect it to be. And so I'm just still a little confused why this would be better, because if a bidder puts in their bid, they can meet all the criteria. You know that they have the staff to complete a project on time, or you have, I mean, maybe build in a penalty if they don't complete the project on time. You know, I guess I'm still a little puzzled as to why we can't keep the low bid with the criteria that we already know. They can become disqualified if they don't meet the qualifications.
Well, again, Senator Roebling, it is important to remember that we're not eliminating low bid. So the low bid still exists, and low bid can be used by any agency or political subdivision who wishes to use it. This does create an alternative. Now, in response to the question, is this necessary, which I kind of think is the fundamental heart of the question, I think the answer is yes for a couple of reasons. First, because many of the solutions that you just suggested are post hoc solutions that don't necessarily result in savings to the state. The idea of best value is that the price that you're getting includes a warranty of great value, whereas under the low bid system, all you're getting is a warranty of what they believe the cost is at the moment they submit the bid. So you have overruns, you have change orders, you have delays, you have punch lists, you have all of this occurring after the fact. You know, that is a fact under low bid, whereas under best value, because of the increased flow of information about the contractor and about the contractor's proposed performance on the project as well as their past performance, you get a better sense of whether or not those things are likely, the punch lists, the change orders, the delays. And so that's why this is necessary. And I think in another question that may be lurking in your question, the departments and the political subdivisions who use this process still have to, you know, set out detailed plans. I mean, they're still using specs under the request for proposals process. And the request for proposals process, by the way, is something that the DOT is already empowered to do in design build context. But they're also required by law, and this legislation requires that the procedures by which they're going to evaluate, or the criteria that they're going to use to evaluate the submitted proposals, must be clearly laid out in the solicitation document.
Thank you. Senator Gimsey, you had a question?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. I guess my concern with this is that we create a whole new aspect within our bidding system here that creates opportunity. And being a businessman and an opportunist, I guess, the way I see it, is that I would bid a project
probably not so much based on the consideration of the lowest price that I can offer, but have a backup plan, if you will, to sell, say, a city or a county board on my view of the project and what extra I offer that would create this best value. You know, and so we'll get into a situation where the school boards and the cities and things like that won't be comparing apples to apples anymore, and a straight low bid concept that is strictly based on specifications, but will be looking at competing interests and opportunity on the part of other bidders. I'm a little concerned that we're going to have a whole new methodology for bidding projects. Now, I like the idea that we're pursuing high quality and better quality, but, you know, that can be built into the specifications, and it seems to me that we could still probably build that higher quality into the specifications and still go out for the lowest bid and achieve the same things that you're trying to achieve with this bill. If you want to respond, it could be taken as a comment on it, I guess.
If you have a quick response.
I do have a quick response, which is that I think there are two things there's one thing that the spec can get, and it can tell you exactly what the department wants as far as a finished product. The spec really doesn't get you a means of production. Best value says we are going to give the departments information about a means of production. And I think as far as comparing apples to oranges or apples to any other fruit, I think that we're somewhat confined by the fact that we're looking at one single project, and they're delivering on a single project. And so I think that limits the range of, you know, that limits the range of things that are going to be submitted for consideration. And under any circumstances, we do want people to submit information about how best they're going to complete the job. That's good for the state, and that's good for the taxpayers, I think.
Senator Gimsey.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, but we already have that system under the alternatives to the bidding process. You know, when contractors come in with their lowest bid, they also come in with alternates and alternatives to the project in which they say, well, rather than the type of, say, roof that you're going to put on a certain building, if you use this one, which is a little higher priced, you'll get an extended warranty or you'll get some additional benefit from that. You know, we already currently have a process in addendums and additions, if you will, that boards and people can consider when they're looking at these bids. You know, that is a best practices type of approach without changing the law and creating a whole new way of looking at it. That's already incorporated in the system.
Mr. Chairman, we around here often talk about local control, the county boards, the townships, and the cities.
We're going to be talking about it more later, too.
They're agreeing what they're trying to do here. And now, if you're a county commissioner, you're the League of County Commissioners said, let's try this. If you're a former mayor or whatever, they say, let's try this. Now, Senator Gimsey, you bring some good points, but, you know, we're all for that local control, at least we say we are. Let them have the option. If they don't, if they're nervous, don't do it. Don't do it. I mean, they want this thing. They want this legislation. So.
Good. Senator Vickerman, did you still have a question?
Mr. Chair, then I'll have a little fun here. I'll put my other hat on. I'm this sleazy, kind of a crooked character, and I'm going to put the low bid in. Doggone well, I can't perform what you want me to do. And that can happen. And if you're forced to take the low bid, be my bid, that would be the bad choice for you to make. So that's why I believe why you want it to be made. If it's must or shall, then you have no choice.
Well,
nay, you can decide if that bid's the right bid.
And this is all shall. None of this is...
None of it's mandated.
None of it is mandated. So this is all a permissive
approach. Don't do it. Just don't
approach.
Do it.
So I'm wondering...
I'll move the bill.
You'll move the bill? I'm wondering if there's anyone from the audience that would like to testify either for or against this bill. Yes, come up to the table, state your name for the record, and offer your testimony. And we do have a full agenda.
I understand. Thank you. My name is Gary Thaden. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Minnesota Contractors of the National Electrical Contractors Association, and the contractors who are members of the Minnesota Mechanical Contractors Association. The contractors I represent all hire union labor. We are supportive of the idea of best value, but we have some serious concerns about this version of best value. For example, on 1.15, it talks about change orders. If I'm in St. Paul and I do a project and there's lots of change orders, and then I go to Roseville School District and they want to know about my change orders, and that's a mark against me if there's lots of them, what if all those change orders from St. Paul were because of the city of St. Paul, not because of what the contractor did? Yet the contractor is being penalized for that. For example, a city or a school district could say, well, we're only going to accept contractors within 10 miles of our city hall. That would be allowable under best value. I don't think that's a good criteria. If their criteria had been, can you get enough people to the job, can you get the products to the job to do the project, that would be part of best value. But if they put in there, you have to be within 10 miles of the project or 10 miles of City Hall, that would be allowable under this best value, and I don't think that's a good idea. In 2.28, it talks about training. It has permissive language for training. It says they may do training. The state may set up a training process for people who are be doing the selection of best value. I submit that this is an extremely complicated process. The University of Minnesota sends people down to Arizona every year to relearn about not only best value but some other things. I don't think school districts and cities are going to be sending people down to Arizona every year to learn about this. This is going to be somebody's job that they do once every 3 years for about 3 months or 6 months, and I'm concerned that these people aren't going to know how to do their job properly. I think that any training, you shouldn't be able to go through the best value process and use it unless there's some training of the people who are supposed to do it. In regards to the Westberg decision, that is a Court of Appeals decision. If this was a Judiciary Committee, I'd be talking about how that's non-citable in any future court cases because it was an unpublished decision, and you cannot use that for any future litigation. So that is actually a decision that can't be cited by any court. So I think there's lots of things that my main concern about this best value is there's not good enough criteria set out in the statute. I think you allow too many people to use it who aren't necessarily qualified to use it, and those are my two major concerns. Thank you.
Thank you, I just think, Mr. Chairman, he's really reading a hell of a lot more into this than you have to. I mean, if you've got a mayor and a city council, they're going to make a decision. You've got to do something within an 8-mile radius or 10-mile radius. I mean, that's ludicrous. They're not going to do that. I give a lot more credit to our local government officials that I'm hearing here at the front desk today.
Okay. Senator Marty has a question.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzen made the point I was going to make. I can't believe that you can make an argument that best value is based on how close to a courthouse you are. The issue here, I think it's a lot less radical of an idea than some people are making it sound. You're still looking for the best price, the best deal. And if, and Senator Roebling, when you were talking about how various, what if they have to meet all these criteria in order to bid for the low bid? Yeah, but what if you make one, the road that you're laying has to be durable for 20 years, and you meet that specification, you get the low bid. But if somebody else comes in and for 10% more has one that, hey, we can make this last 35 years, it's a better deal. And I think the first one met the criteria too. The point is you want people who use their best judgment and factor in everything they can. And I think in most cases they are going to use the low bid because that's not just because that's the option there, but because that's frankly usually the way you're going to get the best deal. But there can be times when you'll get a better deal this way, and if the local officials want to do it that way, I don't think we should assume they're going to be putting up bizarre and arbitrary ways of saying because it's located here, that's the best value. I don't think they can justify that.
Thank you. Is there anyone else from the audience who would care to speak?
Mr. Chair, where's Bill Lee?
This bill is going to go to business, industry, and jobs, and so if there are...
if I have to fix it up a little more there, I'll...
That's what I was figuring.
I know the chairman.
Okay.
The reason I asked Mr. Chair that we've probably done enough damage to it now, and it's got to go on and do some more fine-tuning because we got a lot of bills, so I'm going to renew my motion, and hopefully they can...
Senator Vickerman moves that Senate file 1278 be recommended to pass. As amended. be recommended to pass and referred to Business, Industry, and Jobs. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carries.
Division? Thank you very much.
Division. Is that a hand? Show of hands. All in favor?
That's the bill.
I made the motion. I better be.
Okay. All opposed? The motion.
4-4.
I thank you too early.
Fails.
Well, I wish I had better arguments against the bill, but I guess.
Okay. Senator Berglund, Senate File 356.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Senate File 356 started out to be a bill in a lot different form than you have it before you here today. The reason for the bill is because every year we have hundreds of children fall out of windows and be seriously injured or killed. And I had two of those children fall out of windows in my district this year. One of them died. And yet we know today that we could be installing window screens that would prevent those falls in all of our new construction buildings, and that for many multi-unit buildings that are older, the replacement of those screens could be done with safer screens that would be more economical in terms of the upkeep of those screens over a very short period of time. So originally, we had a different bill. This bill is a result of a compromise with the window industry. The reason the bill comes to you is because it allows the Commissioner of Labor and Industry to adopt rules as a part of the state building code that would require devices that would prevent falls. Those might be window screens and might be some other type of device. And so that's really the reason the bill is here before you. And people agreed that if rules were proposed, that there could be more discussion and dialogue about what appropriate devices there might be besides screens. The bill does require a report back to the legislature on the status of the rulemaking, so that we're hoping they don't drag their feet, because this is important. If we even wait one more year to try to do something about this, we will have dozens of children who die. I have with me Mr. Graham, who can just explain a little bit about the process people went through to come up with the compromise.
Welcome to the committee. Did you get fired?
Madam Chair, now.
Sir.
At committee. My name is Jim Graham, and last year I had helped to create some affordable housing where two children went through. One died. In fact, I call it the Layla Law, the Layla Law, because one of those children fell four floors to the concrete and lived, and that was a miracle. And I say that you don't need a miracle to save children from dying. You just need responsible legislation that requires safety features. This has been a long process, and working with Brian Hoffman from the Building Officials Association and the window industry, a compromise bill has been created that one of the window company's representatives said this is a feel-good bill because everybody wins in it, because it does create the possibility of doing this. I was telling a couple of people that I was sent news articles from last week from Las Vegas and Denver, Colorado, where they had children go out of windows, and they were in those news features. They talked about how there needed to be such legislation. And it's something that Minnesota will lead the country in doing. The law that will be enacted in Minnesota will also be introduced, or that form. They've already introduced the original bill in Iowa, but they will be following suit with the amendments that Minnesota will make on it. So, again, this is a feel-good bill that pretty much everyone that was involved in both sides have agreed on.
and it is something that will save children. We have 4,700 children per year that go through windows and are seriously injured and die. Only those children that are seriously enough injured to go to hospitals end up in those statistics. And you can make a difference by passing this along. It is a bill that will save children's lives. I have the building that one of the children fell through and died. That building cost $7.2 million. Safety screens on that building would have added about $5,600 when the building was built. And I laughingly say if we had chosen to use a different quality of paint, it would have cost more than the safety features that would have saved children there. So I beg you really to pass this along to save those children. We have had mothers with those children and grandmothers who had children that died where they went out of their windows at each one of these. And today we thought that they've been here for all these other committee meetings, so we didn't bring them. Thank you.
Senator Berglund, anything further from you? Are there questions or comments from members to Senator Berglund or to Mr. Graham? Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I'll move the bill, but I had a question for either Mr. Graham or Senator Berglund about you had mentioned you could have had the screens that would have prevented it. I see the other ideas, the bars and so on, but safety screens, what is it, just a very rigid?
Yeah, it's a screen that originally was developed to put on public housing units because of the amount of stuff that they had being thrown at the windows. So it was to try to reduce their maintenance costs by stuff coming in from the outside. Well, the same principle applies. Stuff doesn't come out from the inside. And the screens that are available now would be able to keep all children and many adults from falling through a window. They work just like other screens in terms of being able to take them out to clean them or whatever. It's just a different material in the screen itself. And that would be my preference, but, of course, the compromise bill allows other things. The other things, of course, are much more likely to be taken off of a building and not put back on when the building is painted or something like that.
Okay, Senator Roebling.
Madam Chair, thank you. Senator Berglund, I realize that this is a development of a code, and so I'm wondering if when this is developed, will it indicate, do all levels of windows need to have these screens on, or if it's a first floor window, is it something that will be required to be replaced, or are we talking about higher up, higher stories, so that where injuries would be most great?
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, if you look at the language on 1.5 through, 1.15 through 1.16 and 17, you'll see that there is latitude given in the development of the code for considering the types, locations, and sizes of the windows.
Senator Gimsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So do I understand correctly that currently then there are no testing requirement or criteria for this, that all of that will be set up under this law and vetted through a process?
Madam Chair and Senator Gimsey, there is no standard now for having a screen that can withstand any weight or pressure. So that's why there's so much maintenance on buildings with screens, because literally a cat can go through the screen and ruin the screen today. The screens today that are used pretty much are just for keeping the bugs out, not for anything else. So that's why on multiple unit buildings, there's a lot of expense in replacement of screens. If these new screens are adopted, that maintenance cost will go way down.
Senator Gimsey.
Well, Madam Chair, just one more follow-up.
Sure, fine. Senator Gimsey.
So are you telling us that you have the window manufacturers on board with this? They understand what they're going to be looking at for potential redesign of their of basically all of the windows that our home builders will be putting in their homes.
Senator Berglund?
Madam Chair and Senator Gimsey, they were the ones that we compromised with on the bill, the language we have before us.
Senator Gimsey, I will ask if there is anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify, and if there is someone who opposes the bill, I would ask them to come forward. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify either in favor or in opposition to this bill? Seeing none, Senator Marty moves that Senate File 356 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Health, Housing, and Family Security. Senator Berglund?
Does it need to go there? The
I don't know.
Portion of the bill that deals with window safety education has no fiscal note.
Senator Berglund?
And this bill is already, this is gone through quite a few committees.
Senator Berglund, it does direct the Commissioner of Health to undertake some activity. It doesn't need to go to a finance committee, but Senator Marty, we were sending it to your committee because it deals with the Commissioner of Health's obligations.
Madam Chair, they indicated to me that they would convene one meeting.
Madam Chair, I don't feel a pressing need to see the bill, no.
Okay.
So I think you could
Senator Marty then moves that Senate File 356, as amended, be recommended to pass.
Has not been amended in this committee.
I know, but it comes to us as amended.
Oh, okay.
All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Thank you.
Berglund. I regret that I was not here for the discussion and the vote on Senate File 1278. Senator Vickerman moves reconsideration of the motion by which Senate File 1278 did not pass. Senator Vickerman, is that your motion?
Madam Chair, I move that Senate File 1278 be brought back up.
Senator Vickerman has moved that Senate File 1278 be reconsidered. All those in favor, please say aye.
Is it debatable, Madam Chair?
Oh, sure. It certainly is debatable, but there's no such thing as being on a prevailing side in committee.
Where is it?
Senator Day.
Madam Chairman, Chairwoman.
Whatever.
Senator Vickerman, you got it right the first time. You got it right the first time when you asked, you mean if I have a low bid, this means what? And in the 12 years I was on a city council and a county board, sure I would have liked to have the latitude to say, well, you know what? Your police cars really aren't quite as good. I think we'd just soon have something that's $1,000 more. And then I would argue with you about what is best value. And then I would try and make my case. And then we'd have a huge argument, and we'd have lawsuits, or we won't be taking low bid anymore. We're going to end up having, a lot more money spent on a lot of stuff. And so I'm going to continue with my no vote, and we'll go from there. But I just,
Well, Senator. Madam Chair.
We're on the motion to reconsider, not on the merits of the bill. Is there further discussion on the motion to reconsider? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. We now have Senate File 1278 in front of us. Senator Vickerman moves that Senate File 1278 is amended. Be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Business, Jobs, Industry, whatever the name of that committee is. Is there further discussion on that motion? Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just say that to the merits of the bill, I think it's really injecting a lot of subjective elements, although it may be optional, it's still adding in a lot of subjective elements rather than an objective system, and it's going to lead to a lot of problems. And so that's why I voted no. And on the back to the reconsideration, I guess it just goes to show you can win a battle but lose a war, and I understand who's running the show, so Madam, let's take a vote.
Well, Senator Gerlach, I would have been here, but I was presenting bills in another committee, and I did want a chance to vote on this bill. All those in favor of Senator Vickerman's motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
The motion prevails, and the bill is passed to business, jobs, industry, whatever. Number three is Senator Marty's bill, universal health care system.
I'm sure I have the, I think it's the A11 amendment.
Bigger implications.
Senator Marty has the A11 amendment.
And I'm not sure, I believe that's in the packets as well. And Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate File 102 was before the committee the other day, and even, and this is an existing, it's here because it has a legislative commission in it. It's an existing commission. We were making some changes in the structure of the commission, and that's why the bill came before us, and you indicated that even though it was existing, you wanted to make sure it dealt with who convenes the meeting, when appointments have to be made, and a couple other things that were not spelled out, specified in the current statute that creates the oversight, the commission. And this is the Legislative Commission on Healthcare Access, which has been, had been not meeting much in recent years, and we're asking them to look at big picture at healthcare reform. And so, Madam Chair, I would move the A11 amendment to, which addresses, I think, each of the issues we discussed from your list that we did not meet because, again, it was an existing commission.
Thank you, Senator Marty. I do appreciate the attention to the detail of our guidelines. Is there anyone who, any member that has a comment on the delete all amendment?
Madam Chair?
I'm sorry, it's not a delete all amendment. It's just deleting Section 2 and inserting it.
And Madam Chair, I'm just raising this right now myself, but the appointments, I'm not sure how you've been doing with others, but I recognize that this is, they have to make the appointments by August 1st, 2007. I don't know if you're concerned about how they do it in future biennia or not, but I mean, I think when we usually have commissions, they just continue, they've been continuing to go, so I don't know if you have to worry about that, but I just realized that we're only dealing with the first-time appointments. It hasn't been meeting in recent years.
I hesitate, Senator Marty, with making full-scale kinds of changes to entities that are already in existence with regard to that. But the Healthcare Access Commission already exists. It has a membership appointed now, correct?
It has, yes, I believe.
And it has a chair now. So I think that what you're doing here does just apply to the specific changes, or correct me if I'm wrong, the specific changes that you're making to accommodate the additional members.
Right.
And otherwise, everything has worked okay, you don't need somebody to convene it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Madam Chair, the only exception to what you're saying is the who convenes it was not specified, and because it hasn't met for the last couple of years, that we did suggest that would be alternating between the chairs of the House and Senate committees. The House chair going the first by.
But you name that
right.
Person.
It's spelled
so
out in there, though.
That's clear. Any questions about the guidelines?
If
not, I'll move the A11 amendment.
Then Senator Marty moves the A11 amendments. And is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Senator Marty, do you have any additional testimony?
No, I did not, because that was the main thing that was the bill was before the committee for. And Senator Betso had stricken the first section of the bill the other day because it was just a finding section. And there are no further questions. I'm happy to stand for questions, but otherwise I'll move the bill as amended, be recommended, passed. I think this goes to the floor next.
Senator Marty, since it deals with adding additional legislators, it needs to go to the Committee on Rules. But Senator Roebling, you have a question or comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did you say that you deleted the findings?
They were deleted by Senator Betso in committee when we first brought this bill up. Yes.
They're still here.
That's because it was not deleted in the first committee. It was deleted here, but we didn't act on the bill overall. We laid it over for this section.
So maybe just for so, we should review the amendments that were added in the committee, because we do not have an informal engrossment before us of those, which is just fine, of those amendments. So if members have Senate File 102 in their packets, Mr. Bodern, would you review with us what other amendments other than the A11 amendments were passed in the preceding?
Madam Chair and members, I believe the only amendment was to delete Section 1 of the bill. We gave the committee discussed possible amendments to Section 2 extensively, but didn't act on any of them until today.
Okay, so that means the findings. Senator Roebling, are you satisfied with how the bill is in front of us now?
Madam Chair, I'm still concerned about universal health care and what it might imply. I sometimes think we've been having all this trouble with the VA, which was supposed to be universal care for all veterans, and we find out that, you know, people get put on long waiting lists and they're waiting for services, and that's just a small scale system. And if we go to a full-scale system that's supposed to include all the state's residents, I wonder how on earth we will ever be able to provide the services that the public expects. I have some real concerns about how this could be brought to scale when we can't even adequately do a small program like the VA system.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, we're not proposing here. I mean, there are plenty of ways one could design a healthcare system. Not proposing a government-run program like the VA, proposing one more of the, my personal belief would be, I'd like to do one more like Medicare, in other words, privately financed through the system, but it's run by its private doctors. It's the system you have now. But again, there are plenty of ways you can do it. This is simply the commission is to report back on that. And obviously, you and I and all of us as members of the legislature would have a chance to vote on anything that came back. We're just asking them to try and take a look at coming back with a way of doing that, of providing something that people can agree on. But I personally am not suggesting we ought to do something like that wouldn't be my choice to do a one which we have, like the VA, a publicly run system where all government doctors and everything, but a private sector system.
Is there a further discussion on Senate File 102? Senator Gimsey.
Yes, Madam Chair and Senator Marty, so what we're saying with this is that we are actually doing a study.
Madam Chair, Senator Gimsey, yes,
Marty.
The health care access Legislative Commission on Healthcare Access would be increased in membership, more members of the House and Senate, and they would be required to take a look at developing a healthcare system, but obviously they cannot enact one. We're the ones who, even though it's a subset of the legislature, that commission can't enact anything on its own. It would be reporting back to
Senator Vickerman.
I'm already on page 4, requirements. You're not remandating that. You're just requiring it to take a look at that. Is that right?
Madam Chair, this is we're hoping that they are going to, we believe it's important that they meet the goals of ensuring all Minnesotans have high-quality health care. You'll notice down number 7 that ensures the adequate number of qualified health care professionals and facilities throughout the state, because again, you know, in your part of the state, there's difficulty getting access to providers. We want to make sure that you can see the ones at the bottom promoting Minnesota's leadership, continuing leadership in medical education, training, and so on. I think we want to make sure that we focus on preventive care. There are a whole list of things. It's up to the commission to figure out how we should look at health care, but I think it's very important that we I think this health care reform is becoming a crisis for middle-class Minnesota. I don't think you can find many employers who say it's not a crisis. And now I think many of you have heard that the number one cause of bankruptcy in this country is health care. And we think, oh, those are the uninsured. No, most of those folks, three-quarters of the folks who declare bankruptcy because of health care, they have health insurance. Between they get a serious illness and they go bankrupt trying to pay the bills. And so I think Senator Berglund has a bill that's trying to pick up some of the pieces of people who are falling through the cracks now. I think it's time we start looking at something that everybody has a chance for health care, because our state, there's one class of people who have a constitutional right to health care already, and that's prison inmates. I just happen to think that the rest of us deserve that same right. But we're asking this commission to giving them a big task and trying to come up with a plan to develop a health care system that meets the needs of Minnesotans. Senator Prettner-Solon has one to deal with children this year, but I think it's important for parents and everyone else, too.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, I do, you know, appreciate some of the things you're putting in here that you're expecting from this commission's work. And I guess one of the things that always concerns me about a universal plan is that, you know, even in Canada, they do restrict certain kinds of care. And I see you have that it should not restrict or deny care or reduce the quality of care to hold down costs. So that does alleviate some of my concerns, because I don't want to set up a system which says this person is worthy of care and this person is not worthy of care, and make that a subjective issue, because I think all people, you know, have value, and I want to make sure that we're not excluding people because we don't think that their life is worth it.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, I strongly agree with you on that. I think the idea of, some people say, well, we already ration health care, we'll ration it a different way because some people can't afford it, it's rationed. But I think the important thing is that there are ways to provide health care where you're not saying, oh, this person doesn't deserve it. I frankly think, and one of the arguments I make on why people should have living wills and healthcare directives is, frankly, many of us would say when we're terminally ill, we don't want to be resuscitated. We don't want extraordinary efforts put into us. And I think we should have the right to say that. But I think that's where you save the money, not by saying, well, we don't think, because you've already had cancer and so on, or whatever, you don't value to us. So that's why I think it's very important to have that, not restricting and denying care that. But again, this commission would be looking at all of this, and they would be reporting back to us, and obviously all 201 of us are the ones who would make a decision if we were going to go ahead on something like this.
Is there further discussion on Senate File 102? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak in support or in opposition to this bill? Seeing none, Senator Marty moves that Senate File 102, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Rules. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Marty.
Thank
Senator
you very Larson. Much, Madam Chair, members.
Senator Larson brings us Senate File 1057, High Pressure Piping Systems Board Establishment. The mouthful. Senator Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1057 establishes the Board of High Pressure Piping, and this board will assume, as your summary explains, a variety of powers and duties currently held by the Commissioner of Labor and Industry, including the authority to set fees and adopt rules for high pressure piping systems. Madam Chair, this bill received significant discussion from in the committee that it comes from, the Business, Industry, and Jobs Committee. One of the things we wanted to be sure of is that that we meet the criteria of this committee. We have an A2 amendment that I would move, and perhaps we could have Mr. Bodern walk us through the A2 amendment so that we clearly understand that, Madam Chair.
Senator Larson moves to amend Senate File 1057 with the A2 amendment. Mr. Bodern, would you explain what is happening in the amendment?
Madam Chair and members, just about everything you see in the A2 amendment is essentially technical amendments intended to fully reflect the transfer of duties from the Department of Labor and Industry to the new board that's created in the bill. That would certainly be true for Section 1, which reflects the transfer of rulemaking authority for high-pressure piping. Then with respect to Section 2, that's just creating a reference that can be used throughout the statutes for the Department of Labor and Industry, where it deals with high-pressure piping. And the same is true of Section 3. There are a couple of minor changes beginning on line 24 that deal with some of the guidelines for establishing new boards. Line 24 on page 1, for example, makes it clear the board must select its own chair. And then the changes you see on lines 27 through 30 reflect an additional clause that allows the board to provide per diem and expenses to members in accordance with the existing statute, Section 15.0575. And then the changes you see at the bottom of page 1 relate to, they're basically an attempt to clean up language that's in the bill that authorizes the board to receive its expenses from fees that are charged for the licensing of people working in this area. So you'll see the sentence beginning on the bottom of page 1 of the A2 amendment that reads, the Commissioner of Finance makes a quarterly certification of the amount necessary for expenses for the operation of the board. And then that amount is then, on page 2, appropriated to the board to cover its expenses. And I might add, too, the existing language in the bill requires the board to submit its budget to the Commissioner of Labor and Industry. That's the bottom of page 2 and top of page 3 of the bill. Then on page 2, basically the remainder of the language you see in the amendment all the way through page 4, Section 11, is related to transferring the duties of the board. There are a variety of items that are necessary. For example, on Section 11 on page 4, there's a sentence that clarifies that the Commissioner of Administration could not use a reorganization authority to undo what's being done in the bill, or what would be done if the amendment were placed on the bill. And then Section 12 just clarifies the deadline for appointments and when the board must meet. That's pretty much the A2 amendment, Madam Chair.
Okay. Is there a discussion of the A2 amendment? Is there anyone who wishes to speak in favor or opposed to the A2 amendment? Not the substance of the bill, but the A2 amendment. Seeing none, Senator Larson renews his motion that the A2 amendment be adopted. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Larson on Senate File 1057 as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There are a couple of other issues that we would also like to address. When we were in the Business, Industry, and Jobs Committee, as you see on the agenda, we also have Senate File 1058, and we are dealing with both of those at a similar time when we were in that committee. And the committee had desired to make similar change that it makes in 1058 to 1057. And I spoke with Chairman Metzen as he was waiting to have his bill heard here today, and he agreed that we had just forgotten to adopt a brief amendment, which is on page 2.
Page 2 of the first engrossment?
Page 2 of the first engrossment, Madam Chair. On line 2, the issue is whether or not licensed mechanical engineers should be voting members of the board. And, in fact, through significant discussion in the Jobs Committee, it was determined by amendment in 1058 that, in fact, they should be voting. And we've just essentially increased the voting number of members. So, but unfortunately, when we did 1057, we didn't adopt that. And so the motion would be on page 2, line 2.2, delete who shall be a non-voting, and then delete the language on line 2.3.
And Senator Larson, this does not change the number of members of the group, only the status of this particular member. Is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator Larson moves on line 2.2 to strike the language after engineer and to strike or delete line 2.3.
Member.
The word member. Mm-hmm. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And then the amendment is adopted. Senator Larson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then on, I would ask, I've raised this issue with Mr. Botter, and actually as we've been working on this legislation, the designers and architects had raised an issue in terms of their comfort to be sure that it's clear that that the language or that this plumbing board does not adopt rules to regulate those folks. And Mr. Botter has some language that will provide that comfort language.
Mr. Potter.
Madam Chair and Senator Larson, on page 2, on line 23, delete other. And then before on page 2, line 24, before the semicolon, insert except for persons licensed under sections 326.02 to 326.15. And if I may, there are two other very minor technical amendments.
Can you tell me who those folks are?
Madam Chair, that was in discussions with Senator Larson. I believe that's they are, I can check the exact reference for you, but it's one or another form of the engineers that are doing the work here.
Okay. So this first part of this is to delete on line 223, other, and then insert before the semicolon on line 2.24, except for persons licensed under the statute that deals with consulting engineers.
And then, Madam Chair, the two other minor technical amendments, if you can take them now, would be
okay.
On page 2, line 14, delete council and insert board. And on page 2, line 16, after pressure, insert piping.
So Senator Larson moves on line 214 to strike council and insert board, and on line 216, after pressure, to insert piping, and on line 223, to delete the word other, and then on line 224, to insert after systems or before the semicolon, except for persons licensed under the statutes that Mr. Bottom read. I didn't have a chance to write them down. Any discussion of that motion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. We now have Senate File 1057 before us. Senator Larson, do you have other provisions?
Madam Chair, I have two testifiers who are available to testify. If you are would like to have more information about the details of the change that we're making here, essentially we are hoping to have the stakeholders in the high-pressure piping industry represented in terms of rulemaking authority, and this bill has received a lot of discussion along that front, and so I don't know how deeply into the policy you want to get, Madam Chair.
So I would like to hear a paragraph about what problem this bill solves.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This really goes to, I think, the feeling that our current council that that provides guidance to the commissioner isn't working very well. And I think that the it's fair to say that many of the stakeholders that are being regulated here are concerned that, in fact, their ability to influence the regulation for the public good in this area, and as we get to the discussion about the plumbing board, is limited given the fact that there is no voting authority on the council. This essentially flips that and puts the people who are the experts in charge of the issues that come before the high pressure piping board, and in the plumbing board's case, the plumbing board. After all, it's the folks that we empower perhaps in the area of regulating our doctors are in fact doctors. This bill attempts to put the experts back in charge of the regulation system as it relates to high pressure piping. Madam Chair, if you would like some specific cases where this is a concern, I could ask Mr. Carl Crimmins to join me.
While he's coming up, Senator Roebling, did you have a question or a comment?
Well, Madam Chair, I was wondering that whether or not the departments didn't have somebody who were quite experienced in working with these areas of construction. I don't know. I mean, do we just hire people who are administrators, or do they sit at these advisory board meetings and listen to the opinions of the people in the field? I personally have heard no complaints for either this or the plumbing, and so I am wondering what we're trying to fix.
Senator Larson, would you or your witnesses like to respond to those comments? And certainly we'll welcome participation in this hearing from the committee, from the department.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Perhaps we should have Mr. Dave Johnson, who is the legal counsel for the Minnesota Pipe Trades Association.
Mr. Johnson, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dave Johnson. I'm a lawyer representing the Minnesota Pipe Trades. The current system in Minnesota is an advisory council system where experts advise the commissioner and two or three of the top code officials, and they make the final decision. We are in the minority of states that have that board. Currently, I think it's 32 states have what we're proposing here. And those states run the gamut from southern states to western states to northern states, different climates, different structures in terms of union, non-union, all sorts of those kinds of things. The reason we do not believe the current system is working briefly is there's been a number of instances where the advisory councils have not been dealt with, and have basically, we believe, as a result, it doesn't work. And I'll give you a couple examples. One involves a device called the air admittance valve, and what that is it's a it is an alternative to venting your roof. And the problem with that is when an air admittance valve fails, it seeps sewer gas into your home. On seven different occasions, the advisory council said that they should not allow this in Minnesota. And And at one point, the manufacturer was upset and threatened a lawsuit, and as a result, the commissioner changed the position. We don't happen to think that changing your position because of the threat from a manufacturer of a lawsuit is a good reason to allow a device in Minnesota. We had to go to court, and we ultimately prevailed on that. The second situation involved the adoption of the U code and the I code, where on three separate occasions the advisory council said they wanted it one way, and after those recommendations, the department went another way. We believe that we were left out of the process. We asked that this decision be looked into. When it was, it found that some of the code officials making the decision were aligned with the one code that was not selected by the advisory council, that sat on the boards of commissions that had the advisory council. Issues with respect to whether they should be involved in the commission. I have copies of the investigation for the committee if they'd like to see it or could get it to them. That was shut down prematurely, and while maybe some people don't think it was a big deal, what it ended up meaning was is that men and women I represent, the pipe trades, they ended up having to incur about $12 million in retraining costs, and they had some, many of them had to basically send their training dollars to the very organizations that had an advocacy role in the other way. That doesn't include the cost, and I think Mr. Gary Thaden is here and can speak to it, to the cost that it incurred on the industry. So from my client's perspective, we see it as a very significant problem that has had significant circumstances for us. And so after that occurred, we went and we tried to go to the other states and see what they were proposing. We found that the vast majority of these states have what is being proposed in this legislation, and that's how we got to where we are today. So that's a brief overview, Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling, did you have further comment or question?
Madam Chair, I just wonder, certainly there's various interests that come into any board also, and I sometimes am concerned that when you have the tradesmen themselves, that they are kind of protecting their own turf too. And I know that, you know, maybe there's projects that people who aren't licensed could do, but they might say that we absolutely have to have licensed plumbers do this work because it's a jobs issue for them. And so I guess I have some concerns about that, and I'm looking at the membership of the board wondering if it's balanced enough. I just, you know, anybody can come in with their own special interests, and so even though it's been implied that somebody else did do that, I'm not saying that couldn't happen with this kind of board as well.
Madam Chair, just to briefly respond to that, if you look at the makeup of the board, first of all, the governor appoints, so he could appoint who he would like. I think most of the plumbing work in Minnesota has to be done by licensed personnel. There are four business owners on the board with rural and out-state balance to try and look at the cost side, as well as licensed personnel, and we've tried to model it on the other states. And then just one last point. I think the issue for us is there's going to, you know, we need to find a model that's going to work, and we looked at the other states that have and think this is it. And it's either going to be that we can find a new model or that the legislature is going to become the plumbing board, just because we believe it's broken. This was not our first place that we came. This is our last place after we've exhausted all administrative avenues.
Senator Larson, on your amendment on page 2.2, where you remove the language to say that the licensed mechanical engineer, in effect, will now be a voting member. But then in line 2.13, you said, except for the licensed mechanical engineer and the members from the utilities, which I can understand, all persons appointed to the board must possess a current license. Why now that the, and it may be a very good reason, why should the licensed mechanical engineer, who is now going to be a voting member, not have a current license.
Madam Chair, my name's Carl Crimmins. I'm the Executive Secretary for the Minnesota Pipe Trades. Most mechanical engineers do not hold high-pressure piping licenses. They are aware of the dynamics of a piping system and the slide rule in the calculator, and they know what's proper, but they don't hold the actual pipe fitter contracting or pipe fitter license.
Okay.
So that was the reason.
And, Madam Chair, that was how we originally had come around to suggesting that they may not be voting members, but it was after considerable discussion the committee felt more comfortable reinstating that.
Are there other questions for these two witnesses? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak in opposition to Senate File 1057? Or representatives from the department?
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Tom Joachim, Assistant Commissioner with the Department of Labor and Industry.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to clarify some points that were brought up earlier, and then I'll get into our little speech on our concerns. The group has discussed the 31 states that currently have authoritative boards. We researched that on Friday, and of 17 responding, only 8 of the 17 have authority over adopting which code to choose. They have authority to amend the code, but they do not have authority to choose the. So of the 17 that responded, only less than half of them have authority over the code. The other thing I would like to bring forward, Madam Chair and committee members, is that this is divided. We have members that will testify after my testimony that are pipe fitters and plumbers that prefer the process that we currently have versus authoritative boards. So just to put that on record. I'll follow up with this. In May of 2005, Governor Pawlenty signed a reorganization order to consolidate the 5 unconnected state agencies into the Department of Labor and Industry. Consolidated were the Building Code Division, Health Department Plumbing Unit, the Residential Contractor Licensing from Commerce, the High Pressure Piping and Boiler Divisions that were currently in Labor and Industry, and the Board of Electricity into the Department of Labor and Industry. This consolidation moved the 5 independent silos of code development, enforcement, and licensing of the construction industry into a one-stop shop for these regulatory functions. The bills to create authoritative boards would take a step backward, creating authoritative boards that could choose their own path of code development and licensing. The authoritative board language gives these boards authority over licensing, choosing codes and amendments, and enforcement criteria for the industry. Authoritative boards for one or more disciplines obstruct the goal of consistent code development across the various construction industries that the consolidation was trying to reduce. The legislature has charged all state agencies to develop regulations through the Administrative Procedures Act rule process. The department has used this to gather input from industry participants. Our current process is to ask for assistance and comments from advisory groups. These groups provide an avenue for all aspects of construction industry to be heard and provide input on all rules and regulations. We established balanced advisory committees made up of labor, owners, inspectors, and other industry representatives who are charged to look at all issues and make recommendations to the commissioner. Agency believes very strongly that authoritative boards cannot serve as balanced regulators. The proposed boards have too much control over the industries they serve. The department feels that balanced industry membership, a guarantee of due process, and assurances of no vested interest in the final rules and regulations provide the best protection for the public. Thank you for letting me testify today.
Thank you. Are there questions or comments for the witness? Is there anyone else who wishes to comment on this bill and the jurisdictional issues before this committee? Yes, no? We'll ask you to be brief. We have a number of other bills. We generally meet from 3 to 5:30. We're going to meet from 4 to 6:30, and then we're going to be done. Senator Larson, or sir, if you would identify yourself, please, for the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Kent Warden, the Executive Director of Minneapolis BOMA, Building Owners and Managers Association. On the other side here is Kurt Milburn, my counterpart with St. Paul BOMA.
Do we look like twins?
Do you want to hit it quickly first?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to speak today. My name again is Kurt Milburn, and I'm the president of the St. Paul Building Owners and Managers Association. We are obviously here to talk about the plumbing board and the high pressure piping board, so our comments could be drawn to both boards.
I appreciate that. And we don't have to repeat the testimony.
Thank you very much. The creation of these boards fragments the building codes in Minnesota. With this change, we feel that Minnesota becomes more non-competitive with other areas. The National BOMA has been working on the international code, not national, but the international code for years and years. We're trying to establish an international code that developers, Minnesotan developers, but also developers internationally and nationally, can come to our market and create some of the best buildings and safest buildings that we can, but also create a place, a fair playing field with good competition. I ask the committees to point in any of three directions from this building, to St. Joe's, to Regions, and to Children's Hospital, and you see that those buildings are expanding right now. Those
Sir,
hospitals. I'm
I
sorry.
Wonder if you could speak to the issue of establishing this sure. board
well,
rather than
if
the
you
industry.
Add onerous codes to building, it's going to raise the cost of building, which is going to raise the cost to each segment of our economy, including healthcare. So that's the point back to the boards. These boards create a clear another point, create a clear conflict of interest, Madam Chair. For industry to control the work and control the fees of their own work, you remove a check and balance that we have right now with the Department of Labor and Industry. The Department of Labor and Industry has been a fair and impartial group which does listen to the industry advisory councils that have members on their advisory councils. It's a little like if we came as BOMA and ask to run the councils ourselves as representatives of the building owners. Again, taking out the conflict of interest. And so we wonder why the state would destroy a public-private partnership that works. Thank you for hearing my statement.
Thank you, Mr. Milburn.
Very
Mr.
quickly,
Mr.
I just want to add, Madam Chair, from personal experience, I served as a member of the 15-member Construction Codes Advisory Council until it sunset a couple of years ago, observed the process. As an organization, we also have provided technical experts to each of these advisory committees, not only the building and the plumbing and mechanical code, but elevator and accessibility and so forth. The process in place now does work as an advisory system. We urge you to keep it that way. Again, we're a special interest group. We don't expect any favors. We would ask that other special interest groups also not be given that accommodation. Reference was made to the choice of the wrong mechanical code. We had, as a matter of fact, a distinguished mechanical engineer on that committee. We did happen to be on the winning side on that. We also had a distinguished mechanical engineer on the plumbing advisory committee the last cycle. We lost on that one. They decided to stay with the homegrown code. So we don't always get our way, though they don't get their way, but let's just not try to fix something that isn't broken. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Warden. Are there any questions, final questions, for Senator Larson or these witnesses? Senator Roebling?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I do have some concerns about this, we are going to have 8 licensed pipe fitters on here, basically, and 2 non-licensed individuals. And I just don't know how impartial that is. I kind of think that it's great to have them and providing advice to a more impartial entity such as the department, which certainly can work to specialize, have some people specialized in this area to review the recommendations. But 8 licensed and 2 non-licensed, I mean, they're regulating themselves, and I'm concerned about that, Madam Chair.
Are there further questions for Senator Larson, Senator Gimsey?
Madam Chair, probably not a question, but a comment. Being a builder myself and falling under the Universal Building Code for builders, I can relate to the previous testimony where you have no outlet as a builder, as a contractor, to alleviate your grievances in some cases where your voice goes unheard. And I know there's a lot of frustration in our industry when unnecessary code and unnecessary procedures are implemented that don't seem to make any sense. And I've advocated and always have that that the people who are actually doing the work have a better handle on what's needed and what makes sense than somebody that's sitting in an office in St. Paul making these judgments. I fully support this for that simple reason, that these people can make judgments, you know, this board can make those judgments based on actually having been there and actually done the work. And they have a, with the establishment of this, there will be a process for by which the industry has a way of alleviating some of the grievances and some of the things that are issues to them.
Thank you, Senator Larson. Senator Larson moves that Senate File 1057 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails and the bill is passed. Senator Larson now brings us Senate File 1058.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would again begin by moving the A2 amendment, which largely accomplishes what the previous amendment had accomplished in the previous bill.
Okay, we do have the first engrossment in front of us. Senator Larson moves the A2 amendment, similar, because these two bills are similar, but includes language referring to the plumbing board.
And Madam Chair, I'm not having had a lot of time to go over the amendment. Maybe Mr. Bodern could tell us if there are differences.
Mr. Bodern, how they are there differences between the A2 amendment for Senate File 1058 and 1057 that are substantive in nature?
Madam Chair and members, no. They do basically the same thing.
Do basically the same thing. So I think we had a full explanation of that. Senator Larson moves adoption of the A2 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Larson, are there further amendments that you need in this bill that parallel anything else in 1057?
Madam Chair, there is one additional issue that we would like to address, and that relates to and I'll have Mr. Bodern discuss this with Mr. Bodern, but it relates to an ongoing conversation that's been occurring as it relates to building inspectors. And when we left the Business, Industry, and Jobs Committee, there was considerable discussion about whether or not building inspectors should, in fact, be regulated by this plumbing board. And as we've, in fact, come to some agreement today, an amendment can be accomplished here that I think alleviates some concerns as it relates to building inspectors, and Mr. Bodern has that.
Mr. Bodern?
Madam Chair and members, the amendment on page 2 of the first engrossment on line 17 would delete inspection of, so you remove the authority to make rules and so forth over inspectors, and then on page 2, line 20, delete end, and you insert a new clause 6 that would read, make recommendations to the commissioner regarding educational requirements for plumbing inspectors. And then you'd renumber clause 6.
So Senator Larson moves on line 217 to delete the words inspection of.
And Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
I apologize. Just got the format wrong there. On page 2, line 17, you'd want to delete end inspection of. And then on page 2, line 16, after line 16, insert end. It reads better. Excuse me.
Sorry, just say that again. On line 217, delete line an inspection.
And inspection. And then you'd need another end on page 2 after line 16.
Is the punctuation correct then?
I suppose you, Madam Chair, thank you for catching that. You'd need to delete comma and inspection on line 17.
Okay, so Senator Larson moves on line 216 after the last comma to insert and. And then on line 217 to delete comma and inspection of. And then on line 220 to delete and insert a new section 6, renumbering the others. Make recommendations regarding educational programs for plumbing inspectors.
Make recommendations to the commissioner regarding educational requirements for plumbing inspectors.
Is everyone clear about the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Larson.
And Madam Chair, as we are dealing with this bill, since some of the discussion with the designers and the architects had come up very late before the hearing previous, it occurs to me we should probably make that same create that same comfort language that Mr. Bodern inserted under subdivision do subdivision 2.4, the except for persons licensed under language 3.2602 to 3.26.15.
Senator Larson, I'm not following where you are.
Madam Chair, if you are on page 2 of the first engrossment, line 2.18. Mm-hmm. On the previous bill, we had provided comfort language for the architects and the designers.
So it would be an exception for those licensed under
the reference there too.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Reference to that same group of statutes.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm looking for the list of folks that
I have
impacts. And so maybe Mr. Bodern.
Mr. Bodern has the could you read that to us where it would fit here, Mr.
And
Bodern?
Madam Chair and members, on page 2, line 18, before the semicolon, insert except for persons licensed under sections 326.02 to 326.15. And that covers, in a nutshell, architects, mechanical engineers, surveyors, landscape architects, geoscientists, and interior designers.
Certainly want to bring them into the Senator Larson moves adoption of that amendment following the word or starting before the semicolon except for the persons licensed under the statutes referenced by Mr. Bodern. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill is very similar to the high-pressure piping systems bill. This relates to and creates a state plumbing board and provides the powers and rulemaking authority for this new state plumbing board. It includes two municipal plumbing inspectors, one licensed mechanical engineer, two members who are commercial plumbing contractors, split geographically for Metro Greater Minnesota, two members who are residential plumbing contractors or representatives, two members who are plumbing journeymen, and two members who are journeymen in residential plumbing. In addition, Madam Chair and members, it includes the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry, which will also be a voting member. And again, members, this the appointments to this plumbing board will be made by the governor.
Is there further discussion of this bill, which, again, is a parallel track to the other one? I think the issues were all the same in terms of comfort level or discomfort. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It appears that we again have a big majority of licensed plumbers who will be regulating themselves. I just have real concerns with some of that, and who protects the public. I mean, I know they know their trade, but I think of the public expenses sometimes related to this, and I just am not comfortable with them all. I mean, the vast majority of the membership being licensed workers in that field, and I'm concerned that you have a natural tendency to look out for your own industry, your own jobs, and I don't know that there's going to be enough voices there to speak up for the public in general.
Are there other comments or questions? Seeing none, Senator Larson moves that Senate file 1058 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All who are in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have Senate File 957 before you today. This is the National Guard Non-Appropriated Fund Instrumentality. It's actually authorizing the Adjutant General to establish a fund for donations or gifts from public or private sources for the purposes of maintaining morale, welfare, and recreation facilities at property owned or otherwise controlled by the Minnesota National Guard. So it's something I believe they're doing currently, but they need state authorization actually to set up this fund. And so that's what this does. It's brought to this committee for two purposes, one of which we're about to strike. I have an A1 amendment. And this will initially, the proposed legislation created a board for the Adjutant General to establish and carry out this authority. We're going to strike that altogether and not get into the 15-point guidelines. So that shouldn't be a problem for this committee. The other thing that brings it before this committee is the rulemaking authority. So we can that is the last subdivision 5, the last two lines of the amendment. And so we can certainly take questions on that. But I should also mention that in reviewing this with Senate counsel, it's come to our attention that there is no authorization right now for this fund instrumentality to spend money that goes into it. So we would like this to go to finance after this. And in the meantime, and I don't believe that that would creating the legislative authority for this non-appropriated fund instrumentality to actually spend the money that they take in. I don't believe it would overlap with any of the jurisdiction in this committee, so my hope is that we can have an agreement to work with counsel between here and the time it comes up in finance and get this moved to finance. So,
Senator Lurie, what is the issue that you're going to need to deal with in finance again?
Tom Bodern, Senate counsel, can probably describe it better, but essentially this doesn't allow this entity to spend the money that they take in. So this allows them to take in money from donations and public and private sources, but it evidently would require statutory authorization to be able to actually appropriate money out of this fund.
And Senator Lurie, why? What is the jurisdictional issue that brought the bill to this committee?
The
board and rulemaking.
The board and the rulemaking. We're striking.
I think we can let the finance committee deal with the other issue,
right?
And that's not our jurisdiction.
That's my hope.
And so you're just taking out the issue actually that caused it to come here to start with.
Yes, Madam Chair.
So it's one of them.
One of two. The other one was. The
rulemaking.
Okay. Do people understand the A1 amendment? This is not the Committee of Origin, so this is not an author's amendment. Does anyone have any questions, Senator Lurie, about the A1 amendment?
No.
Senator Lurie then moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We now have Senate File 957 before us as amended. Senator Lurie, would you like your witness to testify?
Terrence Palmer is here from the National Guard. If we had questions that came up, otherwise we'll just move okay. to refer.
Are there questions for Mr. Palmer from the Department of Military Affairs? Senator Roebling.
Madam Chair, the only thing I would wonder about is this kind of odd acronym that they're going to be using. I was maybe hoping you could come up with something a little more catchy.
I don't know how you pronounce this. Can you pronounce it, Senator Roebling?
I don't know. Nappy? I mean, do we have to really put in, you know, the Guard Non-Appropriated Fund Instrumentality?
What does it mean?
Nobody knows what it is.
In civilian world, we call it a rec room. You know, with exercise equipment and stuff. I don't know. This is the Department of Military Affairs.
It's a military, you know, designated term that will be understood by the military, if not by the rest of us.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Exactly right. Okay. Senator Lurie moves that Senate File 957. As amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. Is there anyone in the audience other than Mr. Palmer that wishes to speak either in favor or in opposition to this bill? Seeing none, all those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the bill is passed. Okay, Senator Dill will be joining us shortly from the Finance Committee. I understand, Senator Lurie, that we did not adopt the minutes yet, so I would ask members to look over the minutes from the meeting of Wednesday. Is that it? Wednesday, March 21st. Are there any corrections to the minutes? Seeing none, Senator Gerlach moves approval of the minutes of March 21. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. We're just being kind of a brief recess for a minute or two until Senator Dill joins us.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bickerman.
I thought Senator Dill told me he had a kind of a delete all amendment, does he? Or?
Madam Chair, Senator Bickerman, he does have a delete all. I'm not sure if he's going to offer it because I have a page in line and a delete all, both of which do the same thing.
Madam Chair, my communication with him today is he was going to, but I can't speak for him. Right. It just makes the bill a little bit easier for some of us to accept.
Mm-hmm. And I know that Senator Chaudhry is interested in portions of this bill, too, and was eager that this committee hear the jurisdictional issues that are in front of us. We may or may not be taking formal action on it, but we do want to give Senator Dill the opportunity to present this bill to us. Senator Dill, we do have Senate File now 1402 before us, and we are pleased to have you here. We have been told you have either a page in line or a delete all amendment. Which is it that you wish us to consider if at all, if you wanted any amendments at all.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the delete all amendment is probably the best one to look at. Although if they handed out both of them, they could maybe.
No, we haven't handed out either one, so we will hand out your delete everything.
That's amendment. The A2 amendment, Madam Chair.
That is the A2 amendment. Senator Dill, would you like to explain your A2 amendment?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for giving me some time here. The A2 amendment was put together this afternoon and over the weekend to accommodate some of the concerns that I heard from counties and townships. And I think what I'd like to do, Madam Chair, if I could just, I've got a couple handouts here in this little booklet I'd like to pass out, and I'll explain this kind of in tandem. I'm calling this bill the President Theodore Roosevelt Memorial Bill, Serve Open Space, Farmland, Wildlife Land, Forest Land. And the reason I'm doing that is that because Teddy Roosevelt was the biggest supporter and promoter of open space protection in the history of this country. He preserved 230,000 acres of real estate, or 84,000 acres every day he was in office. And that included 150 national forests, 51 federal bird reservations, 4 national game preserves, 5 national parks, 18 national monuments, and so forth. So he was quite a guy when it came to that. Now, the first, just to explain the bill here, on page 1, line 1.8, that first section deals with comprehensive plans for that counties must adopt when they're when they're redoing their comprehensive plan. They have to they've got to update that periodically, and when they do, we're asking them to take into account natural heritage data, which is available in some counties, which has been done by the DNR Ecological Services. And on line 1.1, there's another provision that the board must consider adopting policies that will protect open space and the environment by considering adopting the state's livestock production policy. Which I'll explain in a minute, but if I'd like the page to pass this booklet out, if they can get up here and do so. And then section 2, starting at line 1.14, a comprehensive plan must contain priority provisions for the preservation of agricultural, forest, wildlife, and open space land, and minimizing development in sensitive shoreline areas that are identified as priority provisions of the comprehensive plan. At the time of the next updating of the comprehensive plan, it must contain the priority provisions, and within 3 years, a county must adopt ordinances as part of the county's official controls that ensure that the goals and objectives of the priority provisions are implemented. Now, starting in line 1.21, the county shall consider, now I've changed that word to shall consider so it's a little bit more permissive, and throughout this, the rest of this amendment, you'll see more permissive language than I had earlier. The county shall consider the following goals and objectives. Number one, minimizing the fragmentation and development of agricultural, forest, wildlife, and open space lands. Number two, minimizing further development in sensitive shoreland areas. Number three, minimizing development near wildlife management areas, scientific and natural areas, and scenic centers. Number four, encouraging development within city limits. Number five, encouraging development close to places of employment, shopping centers, schools, mass transit, and other public and private service centers. Number six, encouraging farms, privately owned forest lands, and other privately owned open spaces to stay in business and not sell for development. Now, if you go to page 2, when you get the plan updated, when updating the plan, the county board or the board of the joint planning district must consider natural heritage data. Oh, I've already covered that. That's just a repeat. Going down to section 4, this is a development priority, which is kind of a recommended development priority for counties to adopt. And I've got more permissive language in here than I had before. In adopting official controls after July 1st of 2007, the county shall consider rather than must consider, restricting new residential, commercial, and industrial development so that new development takes place in areas under the following priority sequence. Number one, the highest priority be given to new development in a statutory or home rule charter city in which city water and sewer service is available. Number two, the next priority is in areas immediately adjacent to the city that is zoned for residential, commercial, or industrial development that has city and water service available or will be available in the near future. Number three, the next priority is in areas where cluster development is permitted and community water and sewer service is currently available. The fourth priority is in areas in which cluster development is permitted but community water and sewer service is not available. The next priority is for scattered development in which no more than one development or residential unit for each 160 acres would be permitted. And the final priority would be for scattered development in which more than one development or residential unit is allowed for 160 acres. Now that could be 10 acres or 40 acres. Different counties do it different ways. I have one other handout here I'd like to have somebody pass out. Now if we take the, I guess you took all those books. I don't have a single book. Okay, I just, to finish up the rest of this, the second part of this is kind of a repeat of what I just read, which applies to municipalities and townships. So if you take the book that I put together here called Livestock is Good for the Economy and Good for the Environment, I'm just going to refer you to a few key pages here. If you turn to page 3, get a hold of that book and turn to page 3, the livestock production policy for the state is identified here, and it identifies the fact that, well, the summary is down below. It is Minnesota state policy to promote environmental protection, including soil erosion control and water quality improvement by increasing livestock production. Now, that may seem a little bizarre to some of you to actually protect the environment with livestock, but I'll try to make that point here a little bit later in the presentation. Now, if you go to page 16, there's a very important point here I want to make on page 16. If you can turn your books to page 16, it'll show the on the top chart here the number of farms and land and farms and their average size starting in 1993 and going to 2006. And I want to direct your attention to land and farms 1993, 29,700,000 acres. This is from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And if you drop down to the year 2006, you'll see we're at 27,400,000. In other words, we've lost 2.3 million acres of farmland in just the last 13 or 14 years. So at that rate of decline in about 170 years, we won't have any farmland left in the state. So I think the time has come for us to get serious on that matter. Now if you go to page 19, the page there that identifies the number of ways in which livestock helps protect the environment, which I'm just going to go through this briefly to kind of justify why I've got that first component in there. And number one is that with cattle, sheep, and horse production, hay, pasture, and small grain production increase, this rotation controls erosion and runoff much better than the typical corn-soybean rotation and has significant groundwater quality benefits. And then on items 2 and 3, this is making the point that if you use manure for fertilizer, you increase water-holding capacity of the soil. So when the rain falls, it goes straight in rather than running off. So you wind up with less soil runoff and less erosion, soil loss, and phosphorus runoff when you're using manure than with commercial fertilizer. And then drop down to point number 4 there. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency study completed in 2004 found that only 1% of the phosphorus entering our surface waters is coming from feedlots. I want to stop there and direct you to the page across from the page 19, page 20. This is estimated total phosphorus contributions for Minnesota surface waters. And you'll see the cropland and pasture runoff at 26%, atmospheric deposition at 13%, commercial industrial water use at 12%, stream bank erosion 11%, municipal sewage treatment plants at 10.9%, and so on. Feedlots are only at 1% of the problem for the whole state. Then if you go back to item number 5 on page 19, the nitrogen leaching losses on fields fertilized with manure applied at agronomic rates are comparable and sometimes less than fields using commercial fertilizer. Manure has the advantage of slowly releasing nitrogen over a two-year period. And then on item 6, acreages of perennial forages such as alfalfa and clover are increased with dairy and beef operations. These crops are excellent at reducing nitrate leaching losses, which are 30 to 50 times less than a corn-soybean rotation. So with the livestock, you got more hay and so forth produced, so you got a lot less nitrogen leaching. Item number 7, this is research from southeastern Minnesota that shows that streams and pastures that were rotationally grazed had better water quality than the same streams and areas that were not grazed. And then the bottom one, 9-8, is really where I'm focusing here on urban sprawl. Farmers that produce livestock are more likely to make a living on the farm and will continue to farm in the future. Successful farms ensure that open space and agricultural land is preserved while habitat is protected. Selling off lots for non-farm development is less likely to occur. This helps address one of the major concerns many environmental organizations have, and that's controlling urban sprawl. So if we just quickly get to page 27, this is the summary. A properly sited and engineered livestock farm that is properly managed follows the new 70-20 rules, feedlot rules, and implements best management practices is good for the environment because there's less erosion, soil erosion, less water runoff, less phosphorus runoff, less nitrogen leaching, better soil fertility, better water quality, less urban sprawl, fewer vehicles on the road commuting to distant jobs, more diversity in cropping systems, more pasture land, fewer row crops on marginal land, more open space is preserved, more agricultural land is preserved, more wildlife habitat is protected, better control of plant disease, weed and insect cycles, and better odor control. So that's why that's in there. The fact of the matter is we don't have enough money to buy all these development rights and protect open space in that manner. We have to do it through other means. And one way we can do it is by encouraging people that own open space to continue making money with it. It could be forest land. It could be farmland. It could be land and pasture and other uses. But that's one of the functions of this. Now, if I could just have somebody quick pass out one more handout here, and I'll wrap this thing up.
This is very impressive, Senator Dill.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Vickerman, while we're waiting
Senator
for the next
Senator Dill, we haven't adopted the A2 amendment, have we?
No, Senator Dill was presenting his stuff, and then we'll get to that in just a moment.
Senator Dill, when you get ready explaining it, I'll move that we
yes,
adopt that so you get the bill.
Fine. Now, I just wanted to sure. kind of back up here a little bit. The origin of this bill started 3 sessions ago, and I invited about 30 organizations to participate with me in a work group to try to put something together to help control urban sprawl. Senator Vickerman came to one of the meetings, but Senator Becky Laurie came to every one of them. And what I'm passing out to you now is a note that I got from her. And I think it was 2005. But it'll show that her idea on how things should go. And it shows an 800-acre parcel split up into 40-acre parcels with one house per 40, which is a pretty common way they allow for that on the countryside. And she didn't like that. I don't like that either. Instead, she's suggesting a clustered development on the right there. So you've got the homes all in one area with community sewer and water, and that leaves a lot of open space for agricultural and other purposes, wildlife, forest production, and so forth. One of the problems with fragmentation of farmland is you've got these houses all over the place. It's inefficient farming around these houses, and you try to spray your herbicide around the house, and you wind up with, if the house is in the middle of the 40, it really goofs things up because no matter which direction the wind is coming from, it's probably blowing toward that house. It's just inefficient agriculture to have all this fragmentation. And you've also noticed that the problems with fragmentation of forest land, it makes it much harder to log these areas when you've got houses and roads and so forth. Plus, it's very inefficient. Now, some people have looked at this bill I've got, and they consider it a climate control bill because we've got the problem with CO2 going out. There's very few of us that are carbon neutral.
But when you drive 100 miles to get to work and another 50 miles to shop and 10 miles to get to church and back and forth to school and the post office and all the inefficiency of trying to deliver the mail and pick up kids and provide police and fire protection, it's not a very efficient system for us to use up all this real estate. Now, the Department of Agriculture did a study, which I've got right here, which shows that although you may think you're gaining by getting all this development out in the countryside, you're really losing because of all the added government cost to provide services. And the farmland doesn't demand much in the way of government service, but the people out there demand blacktop roads and all kinds of additional services, which runs up the cost. So the taxes you get eaten up and then some to pay for added services. So when
Senator,
yes.
Senator Dill, why don't we go ahead and adopt your okay. your amendment at this point. Senator Vickerman moves the A2 delete everything amendment for Senate File 1402. Is there any discussion of that amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Dill, did you have any other testifiers? Is there anybody else who wishes to testify?
Well, the local units of government are here. I know they have something to say. And there's a gentleman back here from the Met Council. Maybe one thing I could mention to the committee is that when this went through the Environment Committee, Senator Ellen Anderson liked it so much she amended it to include the metro area, which I had not included earlier. So one of the questions here is whether we should take the metro area back out of this bill.
I would like to mention.
And there will be some testimony to that effect.
You want to direct us to what language we would do use? That would be in the jurisdiction of this committee. Where is the language that says metro area?
Well, Madam Chair, it's not in this delete everything amendment, but I did prepare the amendment in anticipation that we may want to consider taking the metro area out, and that's the A3 amendment. But you may want to hear some testimony first.
Okay, and we're going to be on this bill just a very few more minutes. I did say the committee would meet from 4 to 6:30, and we're closing on that. So if you folks would accommodate us in being very, very brief, then Senator Roebling is going to offer the A3 amendment. Sir, if you'll identify yourself for the committee, and this bill goes next to the Ag Committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. Want to thank Senator Dill for the work he's put onto this bill. This is a very important, as I'm sure the committee recognizes, recognition of the types of problems our local units of government are struggling with competing interests for how to develop in the most responsible way to both have strong communities and provide the infrastructure and services we need to. I would say overall that cities are very supportive of the direction this bill goes. It's very much in keeping with the types of ways that we feel are responsible to plan growth and development in our cities and near our cities. We understand that some of our other local government allies have a little different approach to it. You'll get to hear that, so I won't comment on that. The issue I did want to make a specific note to is exactly what Senator Dill was commenting on, the inclusion of the metropolitan area. That was done in the last committee by removing language that limited the bill to greater Minnesota. We have a couple of concerns with that because in the metropolitan area, as the Met Council could also attest to, we have a separate land use planning requirement. Our cities also have to have comprehensive plans in the metro area, and so we could literally end up with cities being required to adopt a comprehensive plan that is not consistent with the Met Council.
So, Senator Dill, I think we're going to deal with that issue right now. Senator Roebling?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to offer the A3 amendment.
Senator Roebling offers the A3 amendment. Mr. McGowan?
Madam Chair, the amendment was drafted to the first engrossment before amended, so the page and line are not exactly correct, but it's easily fixable. The first one
would
be page 1, line 13, before the semicolon, and then the next entry would be page 1, line 14.
So the Roebling amendment is modified to read on line 1.2, delete 22 and insert 13 for the line number, and on line 1.3, delete 23 and insert 14. Is there anybody wishes to comment further on that amendment?
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling?
I just want to
reiterate what was just said, that the whole metro area comes under a mandate for comprehensive planning from the Metro Council. And quite frankly, many of these provisions are included in there as they look at development. And I think it would be a struggle for these are going to affect, like, my county, Scott County, which is partially rural yet, to have two different levels of control over land use development. And so I think we probably should just stick with one.
Okay, and further discussion among the members. We have Senator Roebling's A3 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Dill or Mr. Johnson, do you want to comment further?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to point out that the amendment fixes it regarding county comprehensive plans, but Section 6 of the A2 amendment deals with city comprehensive plans, and the same change would need to be made there. Otherwise, metropolitan cities would be required to adopt this in their comprehensive plans.
Mr. McGowan?
Madam Chair, then the identical language would be incorporated, page 3, line 3.
Where would it go?
Page 3, line 3, after, same thing before the semicolon. And page...
Okay, I'm looking at the delete everything amendment.
Also, same line.
In the head note.
Right. Right.
Okay.
So it'd be identical language. It's 3, line 3, before the semicolon, insert. Then the next entry would be page 3, line 3, after plan, insert.
So Senator Roebling moves the identical language of the A3 amendment to apply to cities in the metropolitan area on page 3.
Madam Chair and Senate Council, Mr. McGowan, would we have to change it, adopted in a city on line 1.3 of the amendment that we had before?
Adopted in a city?
Madam Chair, that's correct. Adopted in a city outside the metropolitan area.
Okay, so the A3 amendment will reflect in all instances that it is this amendment will reflect the language of the A3 amendment as it applies to county, substituting the word city or county and applying it at line 3.3.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Let's raise a question about our regional centers. I don't know how much they do for their own comprehensive plans like Rochester, Mankato, St. Cloud, Duluth. I don't know if this would be an overlap of planning authority over what they currently have. I'm not familiar with their comprehensive planning process or what they actually have. Maybe our witness can tell us.
Mr. Johnson?
Madam Chair, Senator, I don't know details of exactly which cities have chosen to use comprehensive planning. A number of our regional centers have. This wouldn't be duplicitous or duplicative, I should say. It might be duplicitous. But it would actually just say that when they are doing their comprehensive planning, they need to use the criteria that Senator Dill's legislation lays out, and that when they are adopting their zoning ordinances to enact that comprehensive plan, the zoning ordinance should reflect that in the priority of developing first in areas with sewer and water, et cetera, down the list, which is pretty consistent with how we already do our zoning requirements. So I don't think it would have a major impact. It would list some very specific criteria that would need to be included in evaluating the comprehensive plan, however.
So Senator Roebling moves the A3 amendment as applies to cities in the metropolitan area to be inserted on line 3.3 of the delete everything amendment. Everybody in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the calling it the A4 amendment is adopted. Additional testimony, if you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kent Sulem with the Minnesota Association of Townships. We, too, would like to thank Senator Dill for trying to address concerns, and this delete all amendment gets us yet a little bit closer, and certainly a lot closer than we were 3-4 years ago when we started the process. However, it doesn't get us far enough where we can say we support the bill. It still has a number of concerns for local governments, and I'll try to be brief but highlight them. I'm going to work primarily from the 394 sections, because, and I'll cite the identical sections later in the bill.
We want to be finished in 5 minutes.
Thank you. Because there is a lot of duplication in the language county to city and town, and so I'll try to just cover it once. Starting in section 1, on the lines 1.11 to 1.12, it certainly has been improved by making this a consideration. And the same language appears on page 2, or lines 2.34 and 2.35 for local governments. But it still says that, you know, still directing us towards a state livestock policy. And I accept that it's just a consideration, but it's still giving us, saying, hey, here's a preference. And I can tell you from our membership perspective that that policy was extremely controversial, and it's going to send up red flags to start sending people there as the starting point, even if it is optional. A bigger concern is in Section 2, which is pretty much identical to Section 6 of the bill, which is still preemptive. A comprehensive plan must contain priority provisions. So we're being mandated what must be in there. Some of these things are very good ideas, and definitely we would want our folks encouraging to look at ag preservation and open space. But from a legal perspective, creating these priorities and giving a state usurpation of local discretion as to what is a priority, what works within the region, is problematic, and quite frankly, I'm not sure what a court would do with the idea of saying that there is this priority use. That's a new concept from a zoning perspective. I'll drop down to line 1.27, and these priority lists, again, are in Section 6 for townships, where it says encouraging development within city limits, unless the word existing was inserted between within and city, this becomes a pro-annexation bill. And I know many of you don't want to hear that word or debate that policy, but the reality is what happened in one community, there was a farmer. The farm was surrounded by 7 feedlots. That particular farmer decided to retire. His land was bought by somebody from St. Paul. The township said this land should not be developed. This is a rural ag area. It should not be developed. The county agreed it should not be developed. The city said, well, we'll bring it in the city limits, and then it's allowed to be developed, and it's inside the city limits. That land was 2.5 miles outside the city limits. It becomes contradictory to the intent of this bill. You're actually promoting the cities to go out, annex the land, and now say it should be developed. And so that's a problem. Line 1.30, 1.31, encouraging farms, privately owned forest lands, et cetera, to stay in business. That's an admirable goal. We'd like to see it, but it's more of a tax policy, land assessment policy than it is control through zoning at this point. Finally, I'll to keep comments short, because most of this kind of duplicates throughout. There is some concern. I've got it marked on page 2.12. First flag that I think it appears elsewhere, and Senator Dill actually acknowledged this in the previous committee, is talking about city water and sewer services. There are a number of alternative treatment systems that are actually better for the environment than traditional big pipe. We're creating a priority again, pitting one form of government against another, and that's just very problematic for my membership. And my last comment will be regarding the 160-acre provisions. Again, very admirable to have open space and farms, but there are a number of farmers with smaller farms. There are a number of farmers who'd like to have maybe 2 houses so that their a son or a daughter is sharing that farm. Under this, it's potentially arguable that that would be problematic or should be the lowest priority. Again, I don't think that's the senator's intent. I acknowledge it's not the intent, but that's the problem with this bill. The devils are in the detail. And so I'll close by respectfully asking that this bill be laid on the table. It is this House version. There are no committee hearings being held for it. The committees are done meeting. We have been committed to work with the senator, and if we could get a work unofficial work group, I don't want to ask for a formal task force and all the rigmarole that goes with that, but I am committed.
Rigmarole, we call it guidelines.
I did not mean that as an offensive way, but I just meant the timing of this committee tonight. I will pledge on the record to continue working with the interested parties if this bill were to be laid on the table, that so that it can be what it's intended to be, a guidance, guidelines, but not mandates, not preemption of local control. Thank you.
Would you like to speak, please? But it really will be extremely brief.
Actually, Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Annalie Garlitz. I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties, and in consideration of the time, Mr. Sulem actually pointed out the exact concerns that counties have with this bill. We are also we're very concerned about what the language would do, some of the preemption that's involved in this, some of the restrictive pieces such as the 160 acres and how development is prioritized. And we've worked with Senator Dill with this in the past, and we are also ready to involve the planning and zoning administrators as well as county commissioners in working with this. So,
thank you very much. What is the committee's wish for this bill? Senator Bickerman?
I'm sure I have two people out there. One represents Farmers Union and one is Land Stewardship. I wonder if they could, if it would be all right if they'd come up, if they'd like to, and say something about this bill.
If you could just perhaps just indicate whether you support or oppose the bill rather than getting into a lot of details, that would be very much appreciated. Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Tom Peterson, and I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union. And if I had to say today, I guess we would support, you know, laying the bill on the table, because I think there's a lot of other things that we can be doing that should be in this bill. And I brought those up in the Environment Committee last week. So
thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Bobby King with the Land Stewardship Project. We support the intent of the bill, but we think the application of it is pretty problematic, and we would also support laying it on the table and working through these differences of opinions about how you accomplish this goal of preserving farmland and open spaces.
Senator Dill, is this a good place for this bill to sit while you continue to work on it, or would you prefer it to be moved to the Ag Committee?
Well, Madam Chair, members, I do want to point out that some of the new words I've got in here is shall consider, which you'll see on 2.9. And so as far as mandates go, it's pretty minimal. And what I was doing here with my red pencil is taking notes while I listen to these folks testify. And what I'd like to do is keep working on it. If it could be referred to Senator Vickerman's committee for one more stop, I would prefer that, so, and I'll continue to work on it with these people in the meantime.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Vickerman,
when we started cutting the bill apart, all it ends up is rural Minnesota, looks to me like, to try to run everything. Senator Dale, I'm a co-author. We've tried and tried. I don't think this is quite ready yet. I'd sooner have it in ag because it gets narrowed down to pretty near ag issues. And then when
Senator Vickerman, in the back of my head, thought
maybe we ought to hold it off and study it for a while and see if we can fine-tune it, because I have only have
two. Would you like to study it within the confines of the Ag Committee is what I'm asking, Senator Vickerman. What we could do would be to move the bill without recommendation to the Ag Committee, and maybe that would be an indication of where the work ought to be done on this bill. Senator Lurie?
That is kind of what I was going to recommend. I strongly believe in the goals of this legislation as well. I mean, we have land being cut up. We're losing farmland across my area and all of greater Minnesota in alarming trends. And I think this is a really important thing that we continue to look at. But with the amount of problems with this bill, I'm a co-author of this bill as well, and I signed on to work on this as an issue, and I'm very pleased to be here, and I do also think that the Ag Committee is probably a better place to work on this, and so I would move that we recommend that Senate File 1402 without recommendation, be moved to the Ag Committee to continue some of this work.
Okay, you have Senator Lori's motion. Senator Roebling, you want to speak to it?
Madam Chair, I see this a lot as a zoning issue, which belongs here. And, you know, it's kind of how you can use your land and how many homes you could build on it and, you know, just the whole development issue, which is almost, it definitely is a zoning issue. And so I don't serve on the Ag Committee, and I'm not going to see it again.
Senator Roebling, what about if we move the bill to the Ag Committee without recommendation, with the request that it be re-referred to this committee after the people there have worked on these issues, where I think, I mean, I would agree with you, but I think that that's the venue in which the best discussion may take place.
Madam Chair, as long as we get it
and
back.
I will make a request of Senator Vickerman to send it back to us.
Well, that's fine, Madam Chair. I'm a co-author on this bill, and I know Senator Dale's heart's in it, but I don't think we're quite there yet.
We have Senator Lori's motion that Senate File 1014-02, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Agriculture and Veterans Affairs without recommendation, with the understanding that we will make a request to see it again. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Dill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And witnesses. There being no further business before this committee, we are going to be taking a look, by the way, on Wednesday, since there's been concerns raised about language and other bills that deal with boards and committees and so forth that may have not exactly been that in the form that they are now, as they were in front of this committee. So informally, we're going to look at those issues just so members are aware of them. And in particular, I'll reference the one task force or whatever it was that was inserted into the State Department's bill that had not been heard in this committee. But unlike some others, it wasn't inserted in the State Department's division. It was inserted by the full Finance Committee. So we're just going to review the languages in those bills, just very as one item on our agenda, just very informally. There being no further business before this committee, we stand adjourned.